to the city, M7. 184. Okay, ringing for you. Roger. Come on, 2119. I've got all day to wait for your Roger. Thank you very much.
The ABC Social History Unit presents Calling All Cars, the seventh program in the series Bright Sparks, Australian Radio Stories, compiled by Stephen Rapley.
In its earliest days, radio was seen as a telephone without wires. Everyone would have access to the new technology. With radio, we could all talk to each other wherever we were. Some saw it ending the isolation of the people living in the outback. Others had visions of radio as an information network for the trade union movement. The original plan for the New South Wales Labour Council station 2KY envisaged two-way stations in every union branch, linking up with the central transmitter that would broadcast Labour lectures and commentaries. It also proposed a strong Morse code station to exchange crucial Labour statistics about wages and unemployment with cities like Vienna, Moscow and Paris. But this dream of two-way radio didn't fit the dominant view of radio control.
Paris police plan extensive use of radio. Wireless telephony and airplanes gave Paris the quietest May Day in history, enabling police groups to be shifted quickly to points wherever manifestations seemed to be concentrating. As a result, only a few insignificant street fights followed the annual labour reunion, with no serious injuries.
The Australasian Wireless Review of January 1923. That same year, police wireless patrols began in Australia. In October, Fred Canning was a ship's wireless operator, steaming down from Newcastle.
I was approaching Melbourne one night on my 8 to 12 watch, and I had been copying press for the benefit of the ship's crew at large, and what I got was an alarming story about rioting in Melbourne, public rioting in streets, shops being smashed and looted, people being assaulted and beaten over the head, and all kinds of general trouble. The first question, of course, that arose was, where were the police? And it soon transpired that there were no police. The police had gone, uniformed police, had gone as a body on strike. Well, for the first 24 hours, it was chaos. There was nothing to stop anybody taking what they wanted, and they duly did. They ransacked every shop they could break. The whole length of Swanston Street was littered with smashed plate glass, and so was Bourke Street. The only thing the police could do, they took drastic action. They simply sacked the whole police force then and there. No man was ever reemployed, because he'd broken his oath of allegiance. And they all went out, and they set to work to recruit ordinary citizens as best they could to become special constables for the time being. Well, in the course of taking this press news down, I'd also heard, for the first time in my life, the human voice on radio. And that came in the form of a queer announcement that I couldn't account for. Somebody said, when the Morse was quiet, on the commercial frequency, somebody said, "Hello, 268. Hello, 268. I have nothing to report. I have nothing to report. Finish." And that was all I got. I didn't know what that meant at the time, but when I came to Melbourne and made inquiries and found that, in fact, I'd been listening to the first police radio, experimental transmissions. The 268 was intended to identify the one and only police car existing at that time, which was a very old, pre-war, Hotchkiss car, open touring car, which I think had been pensioned off by the fire brigade and had then been bought by the police department.
Shortly before the police strike, the plainclothes division of the Victorian Police had started its night patrols. They kept in contact with headquarters by phoning Russell Street on the hour to see if they were needed anywhere.
Now, this inspired the man who fathered the whole police radio business, whose vision started the whole thing, Senior Constable Fred Downey, who was once described later on by General Blamey when he became Chief Commissioner of Police as the most intelligent, uneducated man I ever met. And he was that. He is an ordinary, plainclothes policeman, but he'd been out on this car on the Hotchkiss, cruising round, and one night he was cruising down in South Yarra, down to Main Road, and he became aware of Melbourne radio station, an enormous mast, you see, a Valsali mast sticking up out of the Domain. And the idea crossed his mind, if only we could find some way of coming, getting radio onto the car, we could get some messages, we could go to the job quickly instead of this terrible delay. And he put the idea up, but he got back, and he was knocked back, and he fought for it, and he was knocked back. And this went on for quite a long time, until suddenly it gelled when the police strike came along, and it suddenly clicked.
Because of the limited range of low-powered voice transmitters in 1923, the next stage of the Victorian Police Wireless Patrol was actually to revert back to Morse. But there was a shortage of police officers who knew Morse code.
Well, hearing this message during the actual strike had whetted my appetite, and I thought, well, now perhaps here's a chance of getting away from the sea. And I was panting to get away from the sea, because you know how it is with seagoing operators. If you stay there too long, you're there for life. You become unemployable. And as the only thing I had to offer was my Morse, I thought, well, I'll inquire about this. And I went up to the police station and asked, and they snapped at me. I was sort of looking for people like that, you see. So I resigned virtually from the sea then and there, and was enrolled as a plainclothes policeman and spent a little time in a barracks in Lonsdale Street, an ex-military barracks, which had become a police depot during the strike, and did a little physical training and studied Paul's Police Offences Act. And presently I found myself equipped with a Webley 32 automatic in my pocket, in plainclothes, and in the car.
The first police wireless car could only receive. Fred Canning set out to devise a way to transmit from the car back to the base station at Russell Street. Because it hadn't been done before, there was little support for the idea. Canning and his colleagues had to beg and borrow bits and pieces to build the radio gear for the car from people like AWA.
After a lot of hesitation, the then Melbourne manager, Mr. Hook, he went on afterwards to become chief of AWA, but there's a manager, Melbourne branch, Mr. Hook agreed to lend us bits and pieces, provided we would be responsible for them and pay for them if we broke them. And on that basis, we got our first low-power transmitting valve, a Marconi. And from that, I scrounged around myself most of the time, and I found a Model T Ford ignition coil, an old second-hand one. And we came up with a transmitter, which we were still not allowed to test. They wouldn't make available a car for us to test it in. We were just wildcat experimenters. We were just, we had no standing at all. So we again scrounged, and we found a gentleman named Mr. Craig, who was a salesman for Thornycroft's, the lorry people at those times. And Mr. Craig, a most public-spirited man, undertook to make his car available at night. He did his work all day and then drove around with us, with the police, all night in order to let us test this transmitter. And at first we were not very successful. He had a lot of weary nights and nothing much happened. But after a little while we began to get the hang of it to a certain extent, and the day came when Mr. Craig, cruising round somewhere down Brighton Way, I think, came across a car smash in the early hours of the morning. And our operator with him was able to transmit the fact back to Russell Street that help was needed. That was the first message it ever was transmitted.
At first, the radio was only used at night, so the gear and antenna was installed in the car each evening before the patrol began at 10 o'clock.
The understanding was that the driver and the operator always stayed with the car to maintain communication. The men would take off in all directions. We actually did very little mileage in those days. In fact, I think an unofficial rule was laid down that we were not normally to exceed 25 miles in any one shift. So, of course, the standard patrol procedure was for the car to pick a district which was a likely hunting ground and park the car at the end of a long street, say, something like Chapel Street in Provence, and leave the car there with the operator and the driver, and the men would take off down the street, some on each side, testing all the shop fronts and looking for signs of trouble and so on, peering into alleyways and generally looking for trouble and seeing if they could pick up any chaps who shouldn't be there, any pedestrian out in those small hours was liable to be stopped and questioned. What was he doing there? And what have you got in that bag? So that was the ordinary way of patrol. They didn't do much mileage. If the men discovered anything down the street a long way off, they'd flash torches on a code arrangement. The driver always had to be on watch, and he'd take off like hell and pick them up. And the same with the operator. If the wireless man got a message, what we had to do then was to turn on the headlights, flash the thing like mad, take off to the crew, pick them up and go off to where we were wanted. So two men always had to stay in the car, driver and operator. They never got out. But the others were doing very largely foot patrol all the time.
From the files of the Victoria Police come these true stories of unceasing war against crime, of day and night vigilance that protects our life and our property, and of the nerve center of the Police Information Bureau, D-24. This is the true story of the taxi assaults.
We had the police dog called Bully, a big black bull terrier. The general theory was that if you ran across any crooks and you couldn't catch them, you send Bully after them and he bailed them up. And he was a fearsome-looking object when he was really stirred up. He opened his jaws, he had a mouthful of teeth, and he looked really formidable. Well, in those days, there was a famous criminal loose in Melville called Squizzy Taylor. And Squizzy was a very artful customer indeed, and very hard to pin anything on him. He thumbed his nose at the police all the time, constantly. He was very proud of himself and his ability to get away with things. And he swaggered about the place, an evil little squat figure, just making fools of us half the time. There was a cafe in Exhibition Street, Melbourne, at that time called the Shanghai. It was open all night, a Chinese cafe. And it became known as a haunt of all-night criminals. And they would go in there for drinks and a snack and so on and confabulation. So the police quite frequently called in there just to see who was there and what was going on. They had nothing to go on, but just to see what was doing. And one night they called at the Shanghai at about 2 a.m, and the driver stayed in the car and I stayed in the car and Bully stayed in the car. Who should stroll out of the Shanghai but Squizzy Taylor? And he strolled nonchalantly across the road from the cafe to the car, leaned his hands on the side of the car and said, "Hello, boys, how's things?" Saw Bully in front of next to the driver, and he leaned out and patted Bully on the head. And Bully fawned on him, absolutely fawned on him, loved him. Thought Squizzy was a lovely man. Our faces were so red. This was our famous savage police dog that would take on any criminal. Well, we let Squizzy get away with that one, but later on he paid the penalty. Squizzy was ultimately murdered.
Mr. Oftrager, I tell us, you were the very first person to put the sound on the air, I think, with Dr. John Flynn.
Well, this takes us back to 1929, when the first base station was installed at Cloncurry, and the sets were these little pedal sets in those days, and they weren't able to talk. They had to talk by Morse. They were dotted in various places, The furthest one that year was Birdsville, which is about 400 miles from Cloncurry, and they had regular communication.
And this all clear sound?
No, this was clear sound from the base, but it was Morse from the pedal sets, and some of that Morse wasn't so good because they weren't Morse operators.
When did words come on instead of Morse?
Oh, that was several years later. I think the first telephone pedal set was used in about 1934 or 35.
Alf Traeger was an Adelaide radio engineer. He designed the pedal wireless, which enabled remote homesteads to contact John Flynn's flying doctor. One person who recollected meeting Flynn was Phil Muldoon from Newcastle Waters.
During the night, the conversation centred around the activities of the flying doctor service. In the course of this conversation, John Flynn assured my wife and myself that we had no need to fear, even though we were in an isolated part, as the flying doctor service meant the mantle of safety for all such people as us. He went on to say that it was only a matter if we got sick and felt that we needed the attention of a doctor or a hospital, that we could send an urgent wire in the morning to the flying doctor base in Cloncurry, and in the evening the plane would be at Newcastle Waters to pick us up. At the time, I told Dr. Flynn that I doubted very much this was possible because the planes were very small that were in operation those days, and the distances was great, and the limit to these planes was small as far as distance was concerned. I did not realize at the time that within the next 12 months I would be the first man from the far out west to avail myself of the opportunity of the flying doctor service and planes. I was on a patrol in the MacArthur River district on the Barclay Tablelands when I was taken suddenly ill. Eventually, I was conveyed to Brunette Down Station, where contact was made over the wireless station there with the flying doctor base in Cloncurry. And the plane arrived that evening, I'm told, afterwards, because at this particular time I was unconscious. The following morning, the plane left for Cloncurry, and the pilot of the plane was a well-known man called Captain Affleck. The doctor's name I just can't recall. However, after we got up in the air, it appears that I became pretty unruly and took to the doctor, and the doctor had to call on Captain Affleck to come to his aid. And during this incident, I became worse, and they decided when over Camelwheel in Western Queensland to come down there on the aerodrome, which was immediately in front of the hospital and adjacent to the cemetery. The doctor, flying doctor, said, "I think we'll give him a go here because I don't think he'll live very long." However, I remained 13 days unconscious, and eventually came through. I'm quite satisfied that if it were not for the flying doctor service, the foresight of John Flynn and all those men that went to help to make up the flying service and make it possible, and with God's blessing, I would not be here today to tell this story.
I think you who've been following our progress and interruptions to progress out there would be glad to hear something of the atmosphere of that lonely land as it has been modified by the wireless transmission side of the Flying Doctor Service of Australia.
John Flynn speaking over the ABC just after the war.
Now, you may have heard people discussing this service in the past, rather bitterly criticizing it because the neighbors could hear your business. There may be times, especially if you're interested in things that other people want to know about particularly, there may be times when you would rather they didn't know your business. But other people, and you may be amongst them, don't realize that in most things, the knowledge your neighbors have of what you are doing and what you are talking about is a safeguard to you. For instance, about 3 or 4 weeks before we came to Innamincka, we had ordered a 44-gallon drum of petrol to be sent up on the mail to Innamincka so that it would be awaiting us on our arrival. When we got there, there was no petrol. And when we made inquiries, we found the mail had not been coming through, and our petrol was probably still in Broken Hill. But not long after, that is, during the next day or two, we learned from the chatter of the people talking over their little pedal transmitters we learned that the people along the track, knowing that our petrol had gone astray, had made arrangements for us to get one lot of petrol in the first place we came to and the balance of 44 gallons at the next place we came to. Well, now, I just give you that in passing as one example of the good neighbor policy made possible by this chatter, which allows people to know your needs as well as your secrets.
Tonight we tell of the advance of learning in the empty spaces of Australia as we present Education in the Outback.
The story of the School of the Air, which is broadcast to children of the Northern Territory, Western Australia, and the isolated areas here in South Australia. One of the major problems of the people of the Outback has been the educating of their children, who are so scattered to the various stations that it is impossible to establish schools, and only in the more settled areas are there educational facilities. Until recently, the children received school lessons by correspondence only, with their mothers supervising their learning. But with the advance of radio, many of these children are now able to hear teachers from Alice Springs broadcasting over the Flying Doctor Network.
The School of the Air was started by Adelaide Meathke, a former inspector of girls' schools in South Australia. She was also involved with the Royal Flying Doctor Service.
There came a day when a sister from the Alice Springs Hospital suggested a health talk to mothers over the network. This proved most successful, so much so that it suggested the idea of the Outback as a community rather than as separate individuals. Immediately came the idea, what about the children? How about gathering together the Outback children as a community and helping them with their lessons? How about a School of the Air? Could it be done? It could. 3 months of experimental work, collaboration between officers of the Flying Doctor Service and education authorities, especially the director of the base and the head teacher at Alice Springs, has shown that the idea can materialize as a practical project, is developing, in fact, rather dramatically. Over the Flying Doctor Network come the friendly voices of various teachers stationed at the Alice Springs School, reaching into the homes scattered across the distance, bringing personal help for the education of the children out back.
This is X-Ray Love. X-Ray Love. X-Ray Love calling 8US. X-Ray Love calling 8US. Good morning, Mr. Pitts. How are you today? And how's the weather at Alice Springs?
8US to X-Ray Love. 8US to X-Ray Love. Receiving you quite well. I'm well, thank you. And it's pretty hot here in Alice Springs. Now, would all stations please stand by for the School of the Air?
Dennis? Dennis, where are you? The lesson's about to start.
Here I am, Mum.
I was just getting my books and pencils.
Oh, that's a good boy. You don't want to miss this morning's lesson, do you?
Oh, no, Mum. Golly, I wouldn't miss it for anything. I wish it was on every day.
Well, it may be soon. And maybe it won't be so very long before you'll be able to hear everything the girls and boys in Alice Springs learn every day.
Golly, won't that be good? Gee, it'll be just like going to school, won't it, Mum?
Yes, Dennis, it'll be wonderful. The correspondence lessons, together with the School of the Air, teach you quite a lot. Why, before you know where you are, you'll be quite an educated young man. Oh, goodness me, look at the time. It's almost 10. Here we are, chatting away. Sit down at the table, Dennis, and get all your things ready.
In some locations, these small radio stations took on a strategic role. During the Second World War, Beryl Adams and her husband ran a coast-watching station on Croker Island, northeast of Darwin.
We had the treadle sets. We had to treadle like mad and gasp in between and give the messages over of what the weather was like, how many planes we'd seen, if we'd seen any boats, or anything unusual. We had a code which was changed every month, and we had to sit down and work that out before we went on the treadle wireless. Now, that went on for 24 hours. Towards the end, about 1944, we had several planes come down on the island. One was a great big American. It had about a dozen men on it. My husband had to go up with the boys and have a look at that plane and take the bodies that were there out. They managed to rescue two people who'd got parachutes and come down, who would have died but for the fact that help was at hand, and the Aborigines brought them back down to the island. And several crashes, we had to go up and find out if there were any survivors. When the American plane went down, they overwhelmed us with kindness, actually, and big boats came in and we were well and truly looked after.
They offered you some food, didn't they?
Yes, they offered us some food. Were we wanting anything? And I said, oh, I'd love some steak. And they sent us in a half side of frozen beef. Oh, dear, we looked at this great big half quart of beef and wondered how we'd manage. But one of the boys knew how to cut up a leg, and once it unfroze, it was no use us trying to keep it because we only had kerosene fridges. And so we all really had a feast. But the thing that we really loved was ice cream. We had, you know, ice cream. You might manage it sometimes, but not very much. But they sent us in a bucket, you know, and that was overwhelming. But it was really lovely.
Did you ever hear any of these air battles going on?
No. When, in 1940, when the Japanese were bombing Darwin, we would count 18, 20 planes going over. And coming back, you would count the same number so that you know that they were either gone or there was one or two missing. And we did the same with our own. Once our own flights began to come and retaliate, we would count and say the number and the type of plane.
When you first saw these big, large numbers of Japanese planes going over and reported to Darwin, what was Darwin's reaction to that?
Just the ordinary business-like, thank you, your report has been received and will be dealt with. That was about the standard reply. But we ourselves, especially if the Japanese came down a little bit low to find out what was going on, we took to the bush.
In Calling All Cars, you heard Fred Canning, Alf Traeger, Phil Muldoon, John Flynn, Adelaide Mithka and Beryl Adams. In the final program, Australia Calling, we'll hear about the origins of our shortwave broadcasting service. Thanks to the National Film and Sound Archive and Crawford Productions for the excerpts from the 1935 serial D24, and to ABC Radio Archives for the excerpts about the Royal Flying Doctor Service and the School of the Air. Ros Bowden recorded the interview with Beryl Adams. Music for the series was written and performed by Kathy Peters, and production of Bright Sparks by Sharon Davis, Peter McLeod and Stephen Rapley for the ABC's Social History Unit.